Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. You're in for a treat today as we have the greatest hit show number 8, where I feature timely and timeless stories. This selection comes from September through December 2021. Okay, well, let's get rolling with 4 quick stories on nutrition. Nutrition can pretty much help with everything as it bolsters our basic health, the foundation of what we need to be healthy. In many ways, we are what we eat. So here goes. First up from Medical Express. High-quality diet tied to lower migraine frequency and severity. A high-quality diet is associated with lower migraine severity and frequency, according to a study published in Nutritional Neuroscience. And also, on related to migraines, higher sodium intake may be tied to worse migraine outcomes. A higher 24-hour urine sodium level is positively associated with worse migraine headache outcomes, according to a study published in the British Journal of Nutrition. So as you can see, a lot of these, one is about general high quality of diet, the other one is specifically to sodium, but these recommendations that are often for like heart disease or cancer generally overlap with other positive health outcomes as well, which is good news. You get more bang for the buck for the positive dietary changes that you make. Okay, well lastly, this is a fun one from Science Daily. Consuming fruit and vegetables and exercising can make you happier. New research led by the University of Kent and the University of Reading has found that fruit and vegetable consumption and exercise can increase levels of happiness. While the link between lifestyle and well-being has been previously documented and often used in public health campaigns to encourage healthier diets and exercise, new findings published by the Journal of Happiness Studies show that there is also a positive causation from lifestyle to life satisfaction. This research is the first of its kind to unravel the causation of how happiness and consumption of fruit and vegetables and exercising are related, rather than generalizing a correlation. The research showed that it is rather the consumption of fruit and vegetables and exercising that makes people happy, and not the other way around. Findings demonstrate that the ability of individuals to delay gratification and apply self-control plays a major role in influencing lifestyle decisions, which in turn has a positive impact on well-being. The research also shows that men appear to exercise more and women eat more fruits and vegetables. This from Science Daily. Is your child a fussy eater? While picky eating is all part of the norm for developing toddlers, when it extends into school years, it takes a toll on all involved, children and parents alike. Reviewing 80 health studies, the research found that a range of factors contributing to a child's likelihood of being a fussy eater. The study found that pressuring a child to eat, offering rewards for eating, very strict parenting all negatively influence fussy eaters. Conversely, a more relaxed parenting style, eating together as a family, and involving a child in the preparation of food all reduce the likelihood of fussy eating. Eating together as a family with siblings and having a single meal at a regular time all help to reduce food fussiness, as did getting the fussy child involved in the meal, either by helping to choose the menu or helping to prepare the meal. Yet if fussy eaters are allowed to eat in front of the TV, or if they are rewarded for eating certain foods, these behaviors negatively influence picky children. Yet it's important to understand that being overtly anxious or worried can actually contribute to increased picky eating. Avoiding getting cross and limiting any negativity around mealtime will benefit everyone. Positive parenting, no matter how difficult it can be in certain situations, is the best step forward for fussy eaters. Top tips for helping a fussy eater? 1. Set a good example. A family that eats together has better eating habits. 2. Schedule regular mealtimes. Regular mealtimes reduce levels of stress. 3. Get kids involved with food preparation. Familiarity and a sense of control can help. 4. Try to have one mealtime. A separate kids sitting encourages fussy eating. 5. Turn off the TV. Focus on food, not on screens. 6. Try to keep mealtimes calm and stress-free. Will be a better experience for all. 7. Remove rewards or bribes or punishments for fussy eaters. Okay, well, next up, want to switch gears. This from Counterpunch. A little radiation is not good for you. In a rare pushback against the radioactive pollution industry, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, well known as a rubber stamp for the nuclear lobby, has flatly rejected an attempt to further weaken the agency's radiation exposure regulations. After 6 years of deliberation, the NRC's 3 commissioners, 2 Democrats and 1 Republican, voted unanimously to reject formal petitions submitted in 2015, urging the agency to adopt a cost-cutting scheme known as Hormesis, which claims that, quote, a little radiation is good for you. The September 16 decision by the NRC says, threshold theory posits that there is some threshold dose below which there is either no radiation-related health detriment or a radiation-related health benefit that outweighs any detriment. The order then rebukes this concept, finding the petitioners fail to present an adequate basis supporting the request, and convincing as evidence has not yet demonstrated the existence of a threshold below which there should be no effects from exposure to low radiation doses. At long last, at least in this case, the NRC has decided not to make radiation matters worse. Okay, well, let's go big with the next 2 stories. First up from the New York Times. Science alone can't heal a sick society. In the winter of 1848, a 26-year-old Prussian pathologist named Rudolf Virchow was sent to investigate a typhus epidemic raging in Upper Silesia in what is now mostly Poland. After 3 weeks of meticulous observation of the stricken populace, during which he carefully counted typhus cases and deaths by age, sex, occupation, and social class, he returned with a 190-page report that ultimately blamed poverty and social exclusion for the epidemic and deemed it an unnecessary crisis. He wrote, "I am unconvinced that if you change these conditions, the epidemic would not recur." Dr. Virchow was only a few years out of medical school, but his report became a foundational document of the new discipline of social medicine. His vision for health went far beyond individuals and the pathogens lurking inside them. He pioneered the careful epidemiological examination of social conditions, such as housing, education, diet and lifestyle, and he denounced the rigid social stratification perpetuated at the time by the Catholic Church. The same conditions of inequality that produced the Silesian typhus epidemic would soon foment a political revolution in Germany, and Dr. Virchow's investigation helped turn him into a political revolutionary. Medicine is a social science, and politics nothing but medicine on a grand scale. For epidemiologists studying the coronavirus today, that scale is still gauged by the mundane act of counting. The counting starts with descriptive statistics on the daily state of the pandemic, who's infected, who's sick, and how many have died. And then those numbers are used to forecast the pandemic's future, which lets officials plan and mobilize resources. Epidemiologists use those data to discern patterns over time and among different groups of people, and to determine reasons some get sick and others don't. That's the hard part of epidemiology. We know that the SARS-CoV-2 virus is the cause of COVID-19, and in that sense, the story is very simple. But why does one exposed person get infected and not another? Despite more than 200 million detected cases worldwide, scientists still don't understand much about transmission, nor what makes an infected person get sick enough to be hospitalized, beyond simple demographics like age and sex. Nearly 500,000 scientific papers have now been published on COVID-19, and they marshal a dizzying array of hypotheses to explain the patterns observed. But a vast majority of these conjectures quickly fizzle out. Numerous studies early on noted the relative absence of COVID-19 cases in Africa and South Asia, for example, leading to many environmental, genetic, and behavioral conjectures, until suddenly African countries and India also were devastated by soaring caseloads. Thus, so many epidemiological theories came and went, such as the impacts of altitude and blood type, but one consistent association held on, and it's the same one that Dr. Virchow found in Upper Silesia. Our current pandemic is socially patterned. This remains one of the few pervasive observations that consistently describe risks of infection, hospitalizations, and death from COVID-19 around the world. Yet while wealth correlates with those who can work from home and order groceries online in rich countries, it explains less well the patterns among larger aggregations of people across states and nations. At this level, it appears that the more salient features that distinguish pandemic severity are relational factors like economic equality and social trust. It comes as no surprise to even the casual observer that the pandemic struck most ferociously in countries ridden with political division and social conflict. For example, consider the number of excess deaths across countries during the pandemic. Looking at those countries most severely affected, such as Peru, Bolivia, South Africa, and Brazil, one sees mostly middle-income countries in political turmoil and with weak social institutions. Countries that had fewer deaths than would be expected based on pre-pandemic trends, on the other hand, are often richer, but also distinguished by high levels of political cohesiveness, social trust, income equality, and collectivism, like New Zealand, Taiwan, Norway, Iceland, Japan, Singapore, and Denmark. Many investigators have reached similar conclusions in research within and among countries on measures of political polarization, social capital, trust in government, and income inequality. It makes sense that political polarization hampers effective pandemic response, but this is where explanatory inference gets trickiest, because we epidemiologists exist like everyone else inside the social forces that shape the pandemic. We are citizens as well as scientists, none of us immune to politicization and the way that it distorts perceptions and inferences. For example, how did the effectiveness of a drug like hydroxychloroquine become a political litmus test rather than a question for dispassionate clinical study? Nothing is gained when basic scientific and policy questions become ideological footballs to be inflated and tossed around. The United States is the dominant biomedical research entity in the world, and so its flagrant political dysfunction becomes a global problem. This infused everything that we epidemiologists did with doubt, suspicion, and a whiff of partisanship. Science is a social process, and we all live amid the social soup of personalities, parties, and power. The political dysfunction that holds America hostage also holds science hostage. Dr. Virchow wrote that mass disease means that society is out of joint. Society's being out of joint means that epidemiological research is out of joint because it exists inside the same society. This is not a new problem, but the dominant follow the science mantra misses the fact that the same social pathology that exacerbates the pandemic also debilitates our scientific responses to it. To restore faith in science, there must be faith in social institutions more broadly, and this requires a political reckoning. Of course, one can cite many specific challenges for scientists. The wheels are coming off the peer review system, university research is plagued by commercialization pressures, and so on. But all these are symptoms, not the underlying disease. The real problem is simply that sick societies have sick institutions. Science is not some cloistered preserve in the clouds, but is buried in the muck with everything else. This is why, just 8 days after his investigation in Upper Silesia, Dr. Virchow went to the barricades in Berlin to fight the revolution. Next up, this from Stat News. Corporate versus public control of science and technology, forging a framework for the 21st century. Science knows no country because knowledge belongs to humanity, Louis Pasteur said in 1876. Today it would be more accurate to say that science belongs to the corporations and investors that have the money, power, and savvy to secure patents and bring new developments to global markets, a change that threatens human and planetary health. As illustrated by the pharmaceutical industry's windfall profits, despite its failure to date to get COVID-19 vaccines to the poorest nations and the poorest in wealthy nations, Pasteur's observation that bringing science to the world is the highest personification of the nation now seems aspirational at best. The pandemic and the cascade of other global public health crises, including a climate emergency, increasing deaths of despair, growing burdens of chronic diseases and mental health problems, and the increasing toll of occupational environmental exposures, demand a new accounting of the cost of the corporate control of science and technology in the 21st century. Here are just a few examples of how corporate control of scientific discoveries jeopardizes global health. The fossil fuel industry's misrepresentations of its own research on the perils of increased fossil fuel use and its active disruption of global efforts to mitigate the climate emergency blocks approval of measures to reverse its threat to planetary and individual health. The food industry's use of new technologies to make ultra-processed foods, along with its focus on products high in sugar, salt, fat, and a brew of chemicals, flavorings, and stabilizers has created a default global diet that contributes to making diet-related disease the leading cause of premature death and preventable illnesses around the world. The food industry favors these highly processed products because they are more profitable than the healthier diets under which humans had evolved. Big pharmaceutical companies use new discoveries in biological and precision medicines to develop new drugs that generate huge profits, even though they help only a small proportion of those with cancer or other devastating diseases, and even if they divert scientific attention from developing drugs or vaccines that would benefit way more people. Unfortunately, other new technologies of the next few decades, artificial intelligence, precision agriculture, and the development of new medical devices and medical diagnostics, risk extending global health and social disasters if their deployment is controlled by corporations that value maximizing profit over promoting the public good. The coronavirus pandemic, rising public concern about global warming, the defeat of Donald Trump, and growing support for more progressive national priorities open new opportunities for rethinking the public policies that have allowed corporations to capture the use of science and technology for private gains. While most elected officials will continue to focus on short-term changes that could become regulations or laws in the next 2 years, advocates for more public-controlled science and medicine have an important opportunity to articulate a longer-term vision and agenda. Such a platform might package several ideas that until now have been discussed separately. Reforms of patent laws should strengthen the public's right to benefit from taxpayer-funded science, limit sole proprietary control of life-saving discoveries, expand compulsory licensing of essential medicines, and restrict patenting of biological materials. Industry has consistently exaggerated the benefits of the current corporate control of patenting and minimized the cost to public health of its control of science. Growing public control of intellectual property can help translate Pasteur's vision into practice. New approaches to negotiating multilateral and bilateral trade treaties can limit corporate use of new knowledge for private gain. Increasingly, trade and investment treaties privilege investors over governments and enable international corporations to bypass scientific evidence and challenge public health policies enacted through national democratic processes. Limiting the use of secret, corporate-controlled investor-state dispute settlement panels to resolve trade conflicts between governments and corporations that affect public health. Ending the use of trade treaties that enable indefinite extensions of exclusionary rights on patented medical products, a practice known as evergreening, and barring the use of trade agreements to block nations from regulating food and beverages that contribute to diet-related diseases could restore the capacity of national governments to use science to protect public health. Another key goal is to denormalize corporate misinformation and obfuscation campaigns. Following the playbook written by the fossil fuel and tobacco industries, behemoth food companies such as Coca-Cola, PepsiCo, and others have funded research to downplay the role of sugary beverages in dietary diseases and promote physical activity instead. This misrepresentation has been used to defeat public health measures to reduce consumption of the products most associated with the global rise of obesity. By developing legal measures that make industries liable for the health costs of their disinformation campaigns, and by encouraging socially responsible investors to disinvest from companies and industries that misinform the public, science and public health advocates can build support for higher degrees of corporate accountability. Universities, scientific journals, and medical institutions can develop and enforce rules and organizational cultures that discourage financial conflicts of interest and sanction those who violate these norms. The COVID-19 pandemic has highlighted that public trust in and credibility of the scientific community form an essential foundation for effective public health programs. When researchers, clinicians, or public health agencies accept industry money to fund studies that corporate executives have designed, accept payments for prescribing certain products, or fail to disclose funding sources for their research, they diminish that trust and credibility, jeopardizing success in controlling future health crises. Strengthening democracy and limiting the political influence of private interests creates a more level playing field for public debates on science and technology. Reversing Citizens United and the Supreme Court decision that expands constitutional protection of free speech to corporations, blocking the revolving door between government and industry, and limiting the power of corporate lobbyists to preempt state and local public health regulations on food, pharmaceuticals, and firearms can help create a more level political playing field in which public interests can compete fairly with private ones. Are the public health crises of the last decade harbingers of a world doomed to declining human and planetary health, or a wake-up call to act now to create a better future? By advancing a comprehensive vision of a society in which the science and technology produced by humanity serve the public good rather than private interests, health professionals, researchers, and scientific organizations can contribute to a healthier, more equitable, and sustainable future. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo, We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, next up from the conversation on a big issue in health and public health, how placebos work is not fully understood, but alternative theory of consciousness holds some clues. The ability of the mind to generate the symptoms of illness is known as the nocebo effect. The nocebo effect is the unpopular twin brother of the placebo effect. Whereas the placebo effect alleviates pain and the symptoms of illness, the nocebo effect does the opposite. It generates pain and symptoms. A 2018 study found that almost half of participants in placebo trials experience side effects, even though they are taking inert substances. There was a similar finding in the first major trial of the Pfizer COVID vaccine in 2020. In the placebo group, who were not given the vaccine, between a quarter and a third of people reported fatigue. A similar number reported headaches, and around 10% reported muscle pain. Indeed, Martin Michaelis and Mark Wass, bioscientists at the University of Kent, recently suggested that, for some vaccinated people, the knowledge they have been vaccinated may be sufficient to drive side effects. Unlike its unpopular brother, the placebo effect is so well known that it needs little introduction. But in many ways, the placebo effect has become so familiar that it's easy to forget how strange it really is. It's bizarre that pain relief and healing can take place without actual treatment, and that powerful positive physiological effects can occur without any real physiological intervention. Research has shown that a vast array of different conditions benefit from placebos. This includes acne, Crohn's disease, epilepsy, ulcers, multiple sclerosis, rheumatism, Parkinson's disease, and colitis. A recent study also found that placebos had a highly significant effect on erectile dysfunction. Comparison of placebos to antidepressants suggests that the placebo effect can play an important role in the treatment of depression. A 2008 study found no significant difference between the leading antidepressants and placebos. In a 2018 study, antidepressants fared slightly better, but their effect was only found to be slightly or mostly modest compared with placebos. All of this isn't simply a matter of suggestion or delusion. Real and measurable physiological changes occur. Studies have found that when taken as painkillers, placebos decrease neurological activity related to pain and make use of many of the same neurotransmitters and neural pathways as opioids. Similarly, researchers have found that when taken by people with Parkinson's disease, placebos can stimulate the release of dopamine, which reduces the symptoms of the condition. Researchers looking into placebos have found that some factors, such as expectancy of treatment, different personality types, and the patient-physician relationship can have some bearing on the effects. We also know that placebos can activate reward pathways in the brain and increase levels of opioid and dopamine activity. That said, the underlying causes of the placebo effect are still mysterious. Perhaps, though, nocebo and placebo effects only seem mysterious because we are looking at them from the wrong perspective. And by this, I mean maybe if we consider an alternative view of consciousness, the placebo and nocebo effect could begin to make more sense. In modern Western culture, the mind is usually seen as a byproduct of the brain, a kind of shadow cast by neurological processes. Mental phenomena such as thoughts, memories, and feelings are thought to be produced by brain activity. If we have psychological problems, they are thought to be due to neurological imbalances that can be corrected by medication. But if this assumption is correct, how is it possible for mental processes to influence the body as well as the brain in such a powerful way? Indeed, the difficulties of explaining consciousness purely in terms of brain processes have grown so acute that some philosophers and scientists have adopted an alternative view, that consciousness is not a direct product of the brain, but a fundamental universal quality, like mass or gravity. Other scientists and philosophers have adopted similar theories, which suggests that the mind or consciousness is a basic quality of material particles. More mainstream scientists still hope that a neurological explanation of consciousness will be found that will help throw some light on, quote, rogue phenomena like the nocebo and placebo effects. But taking the philosophical idea of consciousness as fundamental might suggest that the mind is in some way more powerful than the brain and the body, and so could influence the latter in a profound way, and it might help explain one day why placebo pills can bring about real physiological and neurological changes in many people. This next story is from Science Daily. The two cultures within science outlined. Researchers trace the outlines of two cultures within science, one of which promotes greater equity and inclusivity. In the world of scientific research today, there's a revolution going on. Over the last decade or so, scientists across many disciplines have been seeking to improve the workings of science and its methods. To do this, scientists are largely following one of two paths, the movement for reproducibility and the movement for open science. Both movements aim to create centralized archives for data, computer code, and other resources, but from there, the paths diverge. The movement for reproducibility calls on scientists to reproduce the results of past experiments to verify earlier results, while open science calls on scientists to share resources so that further research can build on what has been done, ask new questions, and advance science. Now, an international research team finds the two movements do more than diverge. They have very distinct cultures, with two distinct literatures produced by two groups of researchers with little crossover. Their investigation also suggests that one of the movements, open science, promotes greater equity, diversity, and inclusivity. Their findings were recently reported in the Proceedings for the National Academy of Sciences. The team of researchers on this study, whose fields range widely, from social psychology, network science, neuroscience, structural biology, biochemistry, statistics, business, and education, among others, were taken by surprise by the results. The two movements have very few crossovers, shared authors, or collaborations. They operate relatively independently, and this distinction between the two approaches are replicated across all scientific fields we examined. In other words, whether in biology, psychology, or physics, scientists working in the open science participated in a different scientific culture than those working within the reproducibility culture, even if they work in the same disciplinary field. And which culture a scientist works in determines a lot about access and participation, particularly for women. Cognitive science Richard Schifrin, who was previously involved in effort to improve science, but did not participate in the current study, says the new study provides a remarkable look into the way that current science operates. There are two quite distinct cultures, one more inclusive, that promotes transparency of reporting and open science, and another, less inclusive, that promotes reproducibility as a remedy to the current practice of science. A tale of two sciences. To investigate the fault lines between the two movements, the team first conducted a network analysis of papers published from 2010 to 2017, identified with one of the two movements. The analysis showed that even though both movements spanned widely across STEM fields, the authors within them occupy two largely distinct networks. Authors who publish open science research, in other words, rarely produce research within reproducibility, and very few reproducibility researchers conduct open science research. Next, they applied a semantic text analysis to the abstracts of the papers to determine the values implicit in the language used to define the research. Specifically, they looked at the degree to which the research was pro-social, that is, oriented towards helping others by seeking to solve large social problems. This is significant insofar as previous studies have shown that women often gravitate towards science that has more socially oriented goals and aims to improve the health and well-being of people and society. We found that open science has more pro-social language in its abstracts than reproducibility does. With respect to gender, the team found that women publish more often in high-status authorship positions in open science, and that participation in high-status authorship positions has been increasing over time in open science, while in reproducibility, women's participation in high-status authorship positions is decreasing over time. The researchers are careful to point out that the link they found between women and open science is so far a correlation, not necessarily a causal connection. It could be that more women join these movements, the science becomes more pro-social. But women could also be drawn to this pro-social model because that's what they value in science, which in turn strengthens the pro-social quality of open science. It's likely to be an iterative cultural cycle, which starts one way, attracts people who are attracted to that culture, and consequently further builds and supports that culture. These patterns might help open more doors to science. What we know from previous research is that when science conveys a more pro-social culture, it tends to attract not only more women, but also people of color and pro-socially oriented men. In this cultural moment of examining inequality throughout our institutions, looking at who gets to participate in science can yield great benefit. Trying to understand inequality in science has the potential to benefit society now more than ever. Understanding how the culture of science can compound problems of inequality or mitigate them could have a real advance in this moment when longstanding inequalities are being recognized and where there is momentum to act and create a more equitable science. Okay, next up, got a story that takes us back to the real basics of public health, something we may often take for granted in the first world: hand washing. This from the World Health Organization. Investing $1 per person per year in hand hygiene could save hundreds of thousands of lives. All households in the world's 46 least developed countries could have hand washing facilities by 2030 if the world invested less than $1 per person per year in hand hygiene. That would provide basic protection against diseases, avert future outbreaks, and prevent hundreds of thousands of deaths. The 2021 State of the World's Hand Hygiene Report, launched by the World Health Organization and UNICEF, highlights that an annual cost of governments of promoting hand washing with soap at home comes to just 2.5 cents on 2.5% of the average government health expenditure in these countries, making it a highly cost-effective investment, providing outsized health benefits for relatively little cost. Hand hygiene, one of the first lines of defense against the spread of infectious diseases, remains out of reach for billions of people who still lack hand hygiene facilities at home, school, or healthcare facilities. Globally, 3 in 10 people, or 2.3 billion people, lack a hand washing facility with water and soap at home. 818 million children lack a hand washing facility with soap and water at school. And health workers in 1 in 3 healthcare facilities lack hand hygiene facilities at the point at which they provide care. That is astounding. Placing them all at preventable risk of disease, even at the best of times. Almost 2 billion people depend on healthcare facilities that don't even have basic water services. Achieving the goal of universal access to hand hygiene will require dramatic change of gear. The current average pace of progress would have to quadruple to ensure all homes in the world have this access. The same applies to universal access to hand hygiene services in schools by 2030, which will also require at least a fourfold increase in the current average rate of progress, with greater acceleration needed in some areas. If current rates of progress continue, by 2030, the world will have reached only 78% coverage of basic hygiene services, leaving 1.9 billion people without the facilities to wash their hands at home. Hand hygiene is truly no regrets investment. Our estimates show that for every dollar invested, countries can save $15. Wow, the wonders of public health. But the rates of access to hand hygiene facilities remain stubbornly low. With some notable exceptions, few countries have made significant efforts to tackle the need for hand hygiene in public places, for example, said Bruce Gordon, head of the Water, Sanitation, and Hygiene Unit at the World Health Organization. Governments should commit to hand hygiene not just as a temporary public health intervention in times of crisis, but as a vital, everyday behavior that contributes to health and economic resilience. Where else but public health can you invest $1 and get a 15-time return? Okay, next up, news from the Guttmacher Institute. Looks like we're going backwards on sex ed. Only half of U.S. adolescents get sex ed that meets minimum federal standards, new study shows. Adolescents in the United States are not getting the sex education they need, as only about half of young people aged 15 to 19 nationwide are receiving sex education that meets minimum federal standards, according to a new Guttmacher Institute study published in the Journal of Adolescent Health. Researchers used nationally representative data from the National Survey of Family Growth and found that more adolescents are learning about how to say no to sex than about how to use contraceptives, even though abstinence-only programs have been found not to be effective. They also found young people today are less likely to receive information about birth control during formal sex education than they were 25 years ago. The study, conducted in collaboration with Rutgers University, also finds widespread gender and racial disparities in adolescents' access to comprehensive sex education. In addition, U.S. religious institutions are playing a central role in sex education, but most do not provide comprehensive information. Some of the key study findings: From 2015 to 2019, only about half of adolescents nationwide received sex education that met minimum federal standards. Many adolescents do not receive any instruction on essential topics such as contraception and HIV or sexually transmitted infection prevention. And less than half, 43% of females and 47% of males, received federally recommended instruction before they had sex for the first time. More adolescents receive instruction about how to say no to sex, that is 81% of females and 79% of males, than instructions about birth control, with only 64% of females and 63% of males. By comparison, in 1995, 87% of female adolescents and 81% of male adolescents received education about birth control methods. Yikes, about double the number of people not receiving such instruction. Fewer than half of blacks, 33%, and Hispanics, 41%, males received education on fewer than half of black and Hispanic males received education on all the following topics before they first had sex: saying no to sex, birth control, and HIV and sexually transmitted infection prevention. These proportions compare with 58% of white males who received such instruction. Black females, 30%, were less likely than their white peers, 45%, to learn about where to get birth control before they first have sex. Almost no adolescents who received instruction about birth control received this information in a religious setting. Some 92% of adolescent females and 98% of males who received instruction about birth control methods received this information in school. You are listening to a greatest hit show of Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. Okay, well, let's switch gears and move to some food and nutrition news, this from the American Heart Association. New look at nutrition research identifies 10 features of a heart-healthy eating pattern. This is American Heart Association scientific statement. Highlights include, in a new statement on diet and heart health, the American Heart Association presents 10 key features of a heart-healthy eating pattern that can help reduce heart disease and stroke risk at all stages of life. The new statement emphasizes an overall dietary pattern to support cardiovascular health and general well-being that accommodates personal preferences, ethnic and religious practices, and life stages. For the first time, the association summarizes evidence that addresses sustainability, noting that heart-healthy eating patterns are also good for the environment. Also, for the first time, the statement enumerates several challenges, including societal factors that make it more difficult to adopt or maintain a heart-healthy eating pattern, and suggests public health measures to address these challenges, including early introduction of food and nutrition education at all school levels. The American Heart Association has outlined 10 key features of a heart-healthy eating pattern in a new scientific statement that emphasizes the importance of overall dietary pattern rather than individual foods or nutrients, and underscores the critical role of nutrition in all stages of life. These features can be adapted to accommodate individual food likes and dislikes, cultural traditions, and whether most meals are consumed at home or on the go, according to the statement, published in the Association's flagship journal, Circulation. The new statement reflects the latest scientific evidence on the benefits of heart-healthy eating throughout the life, and that poor diet quality is strongly associated with an increased risk of cardiovascular disease and death. The statement emphasizes the importance of looking to the total dietary pattern rather than good or bad individual foods or nutrients. A dietary pattern refers to the balance, variety, amounts, and combination of foods and beverages regularly eaten. The statement also highlights the critical role of nutrition education, starting healthy eating early in life and maintaining throughout the lifespan, as well as societal and other challenges that may make it harder to adopt or maintain heart-healthy diet patterns. We can all benefit from a heart-healthy dietary pattern, regardless of stage of life, and it is possible to design one that is consistent with personal preferences, lifestyle, and cultural customs. It does not need to be complicated, time-consuming, expensive, or unappealing, said the chair of the scientific statement writing group, Alice Lichtenstein, senior scientist and director of the cardiovascular nutrition team at the USDA Human Nutrition Research Center on Aging at Tufts University. Because food is often eaten in places besides the home, the statement emphasizes that it is possible to follow a heart-healthy dietary pattern, regardless of whether food is prepared at home, ordered in a restaurant, or online, or purchased as a prepared meal. You can absolutely adapt a heart-healthy diet to different lifestyles, said Lichtenstein, including one that incorporates eating out at restaurants. It might take a little planning. However, after the first few times, it can become routine. The statement details 10 features of a dietary pattern to promote heart health. 1. Balance food and calorie intake with physical activity to maintain a healthy weight. 2. Choose a wide variety and eat plenty of fruits and vegetables to get a full range of nutrients from food rather than supplements. 3. Choose whole grains and other foods made up mostly of whole grains. 4. Include healthy sources of lean and or high fiber proteins such as plant proteins, nuts and legumes, fish or seafood, low-fat or non-fat dairy, lean cuts of meat, and limit red and processed meats. 5. Use liquid non-tropical plant oils such as olive or sunflower oils. 6. Choose minimally processed foods rather than ultra-processed foods as much as possible. 7. Minimize intakes of beverages and foods with added sugars. 8. Choose or prepare foods with little or no salt. 9. Limit alcohol consumption. If you don't drink, do not start. And 10. Apply this guidance no matter where food is prepared or consumed. That's kind of a new one, but very wise. Processed foods include meats that are preserved by smoking, curing, or adding chemical preservatives, and plant-based foods that have added salt, sugar, or fats. Many processed meats are high in salt, saturated fats, and cholesterol. Research shows that replacing processed meats with other protein sources is associated with lower death rates. Ultra-processed foods are those that go beyond added salt, sweeteners, or fat to also include artificial colors, flavors, and preservatives that promote shelf stability, preserve texture, and increase palatability. Nutrition plays a critical role in heart health throughout life, according to the statement. A heart-healthy diet and healthy lifestyle behaviors, such as regular physical activity and avoiding exposure to tobacco products, are key from childhood through adulthood to lower the risk of developing elevated bad cholesterol levels, high blood pressure, obesity, type 2 diabetes, and metabolic syndrome, each of which can increase heart disease risk. Before and during pregnancy, women who eat a heart-healthy diet can reduce heart disease risk factors, which may help to prevent unhealthy weight gain in their children. Evidence shows that the prevention of childhood obesity is key to preserving and prolonging heart health throughout the lifespan. Later in life, people who eat a heart-healthy diet have slower age-related declines in thinking abilities and memory. The evidence indicates that people of all ages can benefit from sticking to the principles of a heart-healthy dietary pattern. Likewise, it is important to educate children at all ages so they can transition into adulthood. They will be able to make informed decisions about what they eat and serve as positive role models for generations to come. For the first time, the issue of sustainability is included in the association's dietary guidance. Commonly consumed animal products, particularly red meat, have the largest environmental impact in terms of water and land usage and contribute significantly to greenhouse gas emissions. Hence, shifting reliance from meat to plant proteins can help to improve individual health and the environment. It is important to recognize that the guidance is consistent not only with heart health, but also sustainability. It is a win-win for individuals and our environment. However, the statement notes not all sustainable diets are heart healthy. For example, if a plant-based diet includes lots of refined carbohydrates and added sugars, the risk of type 2 diabetes and heart disease increases. For the first time, the 2021 dietary guidance discusses several challenges that make it harder to adopt or maintain a heart-healthy diet. These include widespread dietary misinformation from the internet, a lack of nutrition education in grade schools and medical schools, food and nutrition insecurity. According to references cited in the statement, an estimated 37 million Americans had limited or unstable access to safe and nutrition foods in 2020. Structural racism and neighborhood segregation, whereby many communities have a higher proportion of racial and ethnic diversity, have few grocery stores but many fast food outlets. And targeted marketing of unhealthy foods and beverages to people from diverse racial and ethnic backgrounds through tailored advertising efforts and sponsorship of events and organizations in those communities. Public health action and policy changes are required to address these challenges and barriers. Creating an environment that promotes and supports adherence to heart-healthy dietary patterns among all individuals is a public health imperative, the statement concludes. On an individual level, the new statement reinforces a 2020 American Heart Association statement for healthcare professionals that encouraged routine assessment of patients' dietary quality and inclusion of this information in the medical record. So there's follow-up the next appointment. Okay, next up, let's go big for something that many people might not first think of when they think of public health, but that is happiness. This from Discover Magazine. Are some countries happier than others? The December sun never rises above the horizon on Finland's Arctic North. Even in the far south of the country where the bulk of Finns live, residents witness merely 6 hours of sunlight per day in the depths of winter. Despite this darkness, Finland is officially the world's happiest country and has earned this accolade for 4 years in a row. That's according to the United Nations 2021 World Happiness Report, which is based on a single, albeit subjective, question. Participants all around the globe are asked to rate their happiness on a scale of 1 to 10. Other Nordic nations, including Iceland, Denmark, and Sweden, also hold top spots on the list. The only non-European country that scores among the happiest 10 is New Zealand. Meanwhile, nations including Afghanistan, South Sudan, and Zambia consistently fall towards the bottom of the list. The United States currently sits at number 14. Other rankings show similar outcomes. The Legatum Prosperity Index, which measures economic and social well-being, also reports relatively high levels of bliss within Nordic nations compared to those experiencing intense conflict. And while lack of wealth might lead a nation at the bottom of the table, money alone isn't enough to push a country to the top. Take Hong Kong, for example. It's the 10th richest country in the world when it comes to gross national income, according to the World Bank data, but Hong Kong is positioned in the bottom half of the UN's index, behind nations with lower gross national income such as Albania, Ghana, and Ecuador. However, researchers say stable politics, social safety nets, free health care, and high levels of public trust in a democratic system are the ingredients for a happy population. In the end, it's not the culture, it's the institutions of a country, says Frank Martella, psychology researcher at Aalto University in Finland, who contributes to the UN report. Hong Kong's less than stellar performance is part of a regional trend, which concludes that progress slowed in Asia-Pacific mainly due to deterioration in safety and security, personal freedom, economic quality, and education. India marks another example in which increasing wealth doesn't necessarily translate to rising happiness. For the last 10 years, its GDP has been growing rapidly, but its happiness is going down. This could be a manifestation of political instability in the subcontinent and growing tensions between India's religious communities. So how exactly has Northern Europe managed to achieve such a satisfied state of mind? When we went through all the research on this question, it seems like institutions are best able to predict happiness on a national level. Nordic countries have quite a few things going for them, such as extensive welfare, free kindergarten, and healthcare. These things are key because they mean that people can trust society to take care of them if something goes wrong in their life. According to data gathered by Reporters Without Borders, Nordic people also enjoy the world's least press censorship and corruption. The quality of democratic institutions is therefore high. If citizens have confidence that the democratic system is working, then they're more likely to feel like their vote matters. That's another boost to residents' wellness. What all of this means? Government officials should rethink how they evaluate the impact of their policies. Gross domestic products has been used as a shorthand for success for too long. The ultimate aim of government should be to ensure as many citizens as possible are happy. And of course, that includes many of the social determinants of health. Okay, and while we're talking about happiness, why don't we talk about wisdom? This from Medical Express. Can 7 questions determine how wise you are? Researchers at University of California San Diego School of Medicine report that an abbreviated 7-item questionnaire can help determine with high validity a person's level of wisdom, a potentially modifiable personality trait that has been shown to have a strong association to well-being. Wisdom measures are increasingly being used to study factors that impact mental health and optimal aging. We wanted to test if a list of only 7 items could provide valuable information to test wisdom, said senior author Dilip Jeste, associate dean at the Center for Healthy Aging and distinguished professor of psychiatry and neurosciences at UC San Diego School of Medicine. Past studies have shown that wisdom is comprised of 7 components: self-reflection, pro-social behaviors, such as empathy, compassion, and altruism, emotional regulation, acceptance of diverse perspectives, decisiveness, social advising, such as giving rational and helpful advice to others, and spirituality. Now, that's a lot to take in. I'm going to repeat those 7 components of wisdom: self-reflection, pro-social behaviors, such as empathy, compassion, and altruism, emotional regulation, acceptance of diverse perspectives, decisiveness, social advising, such as giving rational and helpful advice to others, and spirituality. Additionally, the questionnaire was found to strongly and positively correlate with resilience, happiness, and mental well-being, and strongly and negatively correlate with loneliness, depression, and anxiety. There are evidence-based interventions to increase levels of specific components of wisdom, which would help reduce loneliness and promote overall well-being, said Jeste. Okay, well, next up we have a story, rather interesting. One of the social determinants that seems to be very powerfully associated with health is education, but it seems that isn't as protective as it used to be. This from Medical Express. Protective effect of education against midlife mental health struggle waning for Americans. Middle-aged adults in the United States today experience worse mental health than older generations of Americans and also their European and Asian peers. The protective effect of education is waning in the U.S. People born in the 1950s and 60s who have a college education report more depressive symptoms and have poorer memory and overall health than both older American adults and their same age peers in other countries with similar economic structures to the U.S., said Frank Inferno, associate professor of psychology at Arizona State University and lead author on a study. In general, education protects people from experiencing symptoms of depression or having memory difficulties later in life, but college-educated adults born in the 50s and 60s reported worse memory recall than their older, also educated peers. This pattern did not exist in any of the other studied countries. While the future of American middle-aged adults might not look that bright, we can look to other countries to see what works for overall success in midlife, Inferno said. Other countries have more accessible healthcare systems and social safety nets like paid family leave, subsidized child care, and paid work and vacation leave. These differences can help support adults in midlife who are often juggling work, parenting, and caregiving, and suggest ways the U.S. can make things better. Okay, next up, a nutrition study or report here from Food Politics, where the author says, "My latest paper, portion size. My former doctoral student, now colleague Lisa Young, has been tracking the increase in portion sizes of junk foods for more than 30 years. Our latest report has just come out in the American Journal of Public Health, Portion Size of Ultra-Processed Foods in the United States from 2002 to 2021. At first introduction, most companies offered products in just one size. That size is smaller than or equal to the smallest size currently available. For example, the original size of a Coca-Cola bottle was 6.5 ounces. Today it comes in 6 sizes, marketed as single servings. These range from 7.5 ounces to 24 ounces, 4 of which have been introduced since 2002. Since 2002, McDonald's has reduced the size of its French fries and eliminated its supersize French fries and soda, but still offers quart-size sodas and double burgers. While McDonald's and Burger King decreased the size of their largest portion of French fries, they increased the size of their smallest portions. While Burger King reduced the size of its hamburger sandwiches since 2002, they added a triple Whopper. As we have pointed out previously, portion sizes increased in parallel with the rising prevalence of obesity. Larger portions are a problem for 3 reasons. 1, they have more calories. If only this were intuitively obvious, but it is not. 2, they encourage people to eat more. 3, they confuse people about how much they are eating. Our recommendations? We think it is time to also consider caps and other legislatively mandated national policy options to require the food industry to make smaller food portions more available, convenient, and inexpensive. We could offer consumers price incentives for smaller portions of ultra-processed foods. Discontinue the largest sizes of ultra-processed packaged foods and fast food portions. And restrict marketing of large portions of ultra-processed foods, especially those targeted to children and minorities. Our article is accompanied by an editorial by Carlos Monteiro and Jeffrey Cannon, the inventors of the term ultra-processed. Yes, food portion sizes and people have become bigger and bigger. What is to be done? Their point? Reducing portion sizes is unlikely to work internationally. In such countries, reduced portion size of ultra-processed foods would at best have limited effect and most likely would be counterproductive if they marketed to promote their consumption. Generally, the most rational guideline for global as well as personal health and well-being is to protect and promote minimally processed foods and freshly prepared meals and to discourage the consumption of ultra-processed foods altogether, together with statutory measures including fiscal policies and actions. These measures should make fresh and minimally processed foods cheaper and more available. Ultra-processed foods should be made more expensive and less available, if at all, especially in canteens and hospitals, other health settings, and in or near schools. Cosmetic additives should be banned or highly taxed. We have much work to do. Okay, well, next up, have an interesting transition to the next story, both having to do about food and highly processed foods. As you may or may not know, America has the smallest poops in the world of any nation because we have the most highly processed food. But also, we eat tons of protein, which can be an environmental problem. This from Popular Science. Our meat habit is causing pollution issues by way of our poops. Cleaning up human sewage is an international issue. As growing populations grapple with how to properly process and dispose of human waste, a significant amount of sewage ends up in waterways around the world. More than 2 billion people worldwide lack any sanitation, which means that millions of tons of human waste enter into the environment untreated every year. And in wealthier countries like the U.S., most treated sewage is placed directly into rivers and oceans. Human waste also introduces too much nitrogen in our waterways, which causes watersheds to experience dead zones that used to house marine life. The research team used data sets to detail whether populations were urban or rural, how much protein was consumed per person, how much nitrogen was then excreted, and how much of the waste was sanitized and how. The more meat a person eats, the more nitrogen is found in their waste, which means more nitrogen ends up in the waterways near them. This happens because nitrogen comes from amino acids which make up protein. The breaking down of these proteins during digestion creates the nitrogen that ends up in wastewater. Nearly half as much nitrogen comes from wastewater as agricultural runoff globally, which is a huge fraction. The whole ecosystem can tip into a highly degraded state when nutrient levels are too high, said co-author Ben Halpern, a marine science professor at UC Santa Barbara. So while agriculture takes the cake for the majority of runoff-induced issues, there's a lot that can be done for both an ecological and public health benefit when it comes to our own poo. Eating less animal products could help. From a nutritional perspective, I think our excess protein thing is actually a health issue too, and apparently it's a significant environmental problem because the nitrogen that you excrete is all because it's excess protein, more than what you need. Okay, well, let's close out this greatest hit show with a greatest parody PSA. Here goes.
And now a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning. Use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-